And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on a Wednesday afternoon ahead of a typically busy Wednesday slate of games. And it has been too long since we have had great friend of the program, wonderful NBA writer, foodie, travel buddy Angelino, Kevin Arnovitz. How you doing?
Sir, I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. You always say I'm well. My father would like you. You always say I'm well.
We litigated this last time, didn't we?
I don't know. I can't remember what happened yesterday.
I do it with no expectation that any. This is an open question, and I don't consider myself a radical grammarian. Like, I'm just well. Sometimes I'm good. Today I'm well.
So the league is in a funny. We were talking about what should we talk about today, and the league is. It feels funny. Like, okay, I've already talked about the Celtics a lot. That's one of the surprise teams. The rest of the East is, like, about as expected. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, like, 6 teams between 7 and 13, and boy, are the Heat looking not very good at 7 and 13, and 13 and 8. No big surprises. Even the Wizards are 1.5 games out of a playoff spot. They may yet talent their way to 42 wins in a playoff spot, even if they all hate each other. And the West, the entire conference, is between 3 games under 500. That's Utah, 14th in the West. Who would have had Utah 14th? And 12-7, the Thunder are 4th, and then you get the top 3 after that. It's been weird. I feel like it's just still, every time I feel like I have a grasp of what one of these teams is, they lose 3 straight or 2 straight and drop like 7 places in the standings. You feel weird? I feel like this is a weird season.
It's a weird season. The top of the East is more interesting than it's been. Like, I don't, obviously the Warriors are lurking in the grass, and, you know, when Steph comes back and Draymond, I think there's this presumption that obviously they're still the Warriors. But the 1 through 14 thing in the West is fantastic.
Poor Suns.
It just means that there's a relevant, like, game every night. Like, there's only basically one disqualified team in the West. Our Phoenix Suns, and actually they go on the road to Milwaukee and win a game the other day. So it just creates the sort of parity the league values or says it values. I don't know that it actually values it. I think superstar leagues tend to be successful, but we were seeing that parity. Like, what would happen if basically 19 or 20 teams were all of reasonably comparable quality? So for the parity mongers, here's your parity.
I'm glad you brought up the Warriors. We don't talk about the Warriors enough. Let me talk about the Warriors for a second. All these stories I read last week about – no, look, I understand. Draymond – we talked about it at Azeem. Draymond said some bad stuff. Kevin Durant reacted it not badly, but just didn't like it. And with KD's free agency looming, there's panic, or there's real reason to dig into what was happening. But then they like lost, I think, 4 in a row, right? They lost 4 in a row for the first time under Steve. And it's like, oh, the Warriors, they haven't lost 4 in a row under Steve Kerr. Boy, they don't look very good. Steph Curry and Draymond Green aren't playing. Wake me up when these games matter. Wake me up when they have their real team and they're just going to destroy everybody. And now KD has put all these 40-point games together and everything's fine again. Anyway, by the way, speaking of the Suns, I do think one of the fun storylines of the season so far are all these rookie big men. What do you think of Ayton so far?
I like Ayton. I mean, it's less about Ayton and looking at these guys and sort of figuring out, you know, what does that position demand? You know, I felt like maybe it was you and I had a conversation last year about, you know, for all of the Capella praise and a 25th pick, and he's essential to what they do. You know, it wasn't lost on us that he was sitting at key moments. So the question is, hey, like, just through no it's kind of unfair almost, but the question being, if you're a big man who's going to average 19 and 12, shoot the ball close to the bucket at a high percentage, you know, and in the classic PER rankings, you're going to be pretty high up there by virtue of what you do, and especially if you're a high usage big. Okay, you're not a great defender, and I don't know where Ayton ultimately projects, but you know, he's not Mo Bamba in that category. So the question is clearly he's useful. Clearly he will fill out the stat sheet, And, oh, by the way, like, let's say he never becomes greater than a 17-foot shooter, where, by the way, he'll by definition not be terribly efficient, but whatever. Like, we like Ayton. Okay, so now what? Is he on the floor when the 54-win Phoenix Suns, anchored by Devin Booker and whoever else they're either developed
or super team, the super team that's coming to Phoenix.
The Devin Booker super team, right? Like, okay, and, you know, Ayton's out there. And so that's the question to me is I'm having trouble these days kind of evaluating these bigs. Like, I should be impressed. I'm impressed with Ayton. He's got skills, you know, and if this were 10 years ago, wow. And through no fault of his own, I don't know what that – does that skill set – we know that skill set makes him a very, very good basketball player. Does it distinguish him? I don't know.
I like his passing better than I expected. His defense is obviously a complete disaster, but it's I still don't know what to make of it. So he is the worst, I think. He might be the worst I've ever seen at leaving early on the pick and roll. And by that I mean he slides over a little bit to cut off the ball handler. The drive is still happening. The guy is dribbling towards him. And he moves back to cover his own guy, the screener, who's rolling to the rim. And the guy on the ball handler is like, you're supposed to stop that dude. And he just ran away and he got a layup. And I've struggled with how to read that because I think he may actually be the worst I've ever seen at it. On the one hand, I'm thinking to myself, he's trying to do the right thing. This is a new speed, a new position, a new level of defense, and he's sussing out. You see him thinking. You see him thinking. And if he's thinking, that means his intentions are good. He's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to read the game. And maybe when he's 20 and not a teenager and has a couple of years, like, all of that thinking will pay off. On the flip side, there's the devil on my shoulder saying, boy, if he's got to think this much, maybe he just doesn't have a feel for it. I still am kind of leaning towards, like, I'm glad to see him out there trying to figure it out. And I'm not super worried about it. I'm glad that there's a mental effort going on, and he appears to care, even if the caring is resulting in just a parade of layups at the rim.
Yeah, I tend to err on the side of these are young guys, and people can learn things. You know, like there was this. I mean, I remember Peter Gammon saying right at the moment when Major League Baseball had decided, like, yeah, it's good to walk. This isn't just a Billy Beane thing. Like, it's a good thing to walk. And yet, you know, you would have even people who are kind of sabermetrician types say, oh, well, that guy never walks. And Gammon's kind of pointed out, no, he can learn to walk. And then in the next 5 to 7 years, you had guys who swung at everything, all of a sudden kind of reconfigure, almost like a Jason Kidd way, you know, reconfigure their game so that they were, you know, their on-base percentages were 80 points higher than their average all of a sudden. It's like, I think it's reasonable. You can ask people to learn things, and they will often learn them. Like, Ayton might become a good defender, and that pseudo-corral that he's doing now, and I know what you're talking about. It's hard because, by the way, like, I think, you know, talking to the defensive assistant coaches, you know, coverage is, it's not just, oh, we're now a switch league. No, actually, I think we're now getting, there might be this pendulum back, not against switching, but just every coverage is so situational because you cannot throw the same coverage of Karl Anthony Towns slipping a pick and roll than you can, I don't know, Marcin Gortat or whoever else. Like, it is, like, that position that you're talking about is going to require more individual cerebral thought about, wait, who is setting the screen? You know, what is their intention? What is their skill set? Oh, crap. I need to factor all of that in about a nanosecond because big guys' skill sets are so diverse. And for that matter, like, how would Ayton guard Ayton, right? Like, so I'm with you there. I tend to be generous on that. Like, I try not to completely judge young players on their frailties, especially in the first 30 games of their career. I don't know that he ever is going to factor be a great defender, that said.
I'll tell you, Trae Young was about 6 consecutive missed threes away from me starting to worry. But I mean, I know you and I were talking about the Heat game last night. That might have been the bet. He's not a big guy. I've now changed the subject. I'm sorry. But that might have been the best game I've seen Trae Young play in the NBA. Obviously he's a good passer, but he was just controlling the game and making decisions at a level that I hadn't quite seen from him. I thought he played a really nice game.
Yeah, you know, I got a chance last week to sit down with both Trey and Mo Garnett, who's one of his key development guys in Atlanta on that staff, who actually played alongside Steve Nash in the Santa Clara backcourt. Has been doing a lot of development work with Trey, and it's been kind of fun to trace his development because, I mean, obviously there are flaws to the game of Trae Young as currently constituted. I think most of them reside on the defensive floor, part of the floor. But, you know, one of the things Garnett said is, like, the biggest key for him is not to get bored by the simple play. Like, the guy's got so much vision. He is such a great passer. And I never loved the Steph Curry comp. I think it was one of those things where people saw this little guy pull up from 32 feet. So, that's the comp, right? He wants to be Steph Curry. When I think actually, intuitively sometimes, I think he's much more Chris Paul in thought. And, I watched him dish 17 assists the other night against, I think it was the Clippers of Toronto, one of those two games I was at in Atlanta. But, I'm starting to buy on Trae Young. I really like the player. I mean, I'm a little nervous about, like, when those defensive RPM numbers, and I know rookies always get completely slaughtered in that metric, but, man, it's bad. Like decisively 2 points worse than the next worst guy.
No, that's an eye tester. That's an eye tester because Trae Young is – I compared him to a piece of tissue paper sort of fluttering around the floor on defense. He's just sort of – just fluttering, just gets knocked out, flutters over here, flutters over there, gets knocked over there by bigger, stronger guys. Back to the big guys. So you and I have similar taste in the game. Wendell Carter and Jaren Jackson Jr. are just made for us. Like
I have some nice Wendell Carter stuff for our Bulls part of our show. But yes, I'm glad you mentioned him.
I was like, there was just no way I wasn't going to like those guys. They're little Horfords running around, and everybody knows I love Horford. And boy, Jaren Jackson's a bit longer and has that weird little shot put shot that seems to go in. But I'm very excited. The Grizzlies are coming here tomorrow. I'm very excited for Jaren Jackson Jr. to be in. I'm a little too excited. The guy I like more than I thought is Bagley. He has a nice look. They have to figure out, you know, is he a five while we're playing him at the four, and Giles is mostly the five, but sometimes not, and then he plays with Cauley Stein, but sometimes he plays with Bealitza where he is the five and blah. He's got a nice little floor game. Like the 3-point shot, he's 7 of 22, but that's like kind of a decent amount of attempts for a rookie big. But his off the dribble game, his explosiveness from dribble to rim finish, even though he wants to go left all the time, It's more interesting to me than I thought it would be. Because I heard a lot of scouts that it's sort of the Kings effect. It's that whatever the opposite of the Halo effect is, it should be called the Kings effect. As soon as the Kings were zeroing in on him, everyone started to say bad things about Marvin Bagley. And what you heard was, well, he's a big guy who doesn't defend or shoot the three, so who cares? And so I was primed to be like, well, there he is, a big who doesn't defend or shoot the three. Who cares? Stupid Kings. He's actually got a nice little floor game that I like.
Yeah, no, and Carter's kind of part of this, too, where I don't want to discount the idea that there are things a big man can do just gravitationally for your offense just by having that floor game. I mean, when there's a big guy who is making his approach to the rim with skills, you know, we're not talking mid-range shots here. We're talking about, you know, making, you know, being able to get from 12 feet to 2 feet in a single dribble and has a back shoulder, you know, fade that often works or knows how to get fouled. Or has, in some of the cases, like a good passing game so that once that gravitational pull happens and the defense sort of, you know, comes over or stunts, you know, can just find any one of three teammates who obviously are going to be open 3-point shooters to the effect of like 60% effective field goal percentage. So it's like, yeah, I don't want to discount, like I'm not so much, I have certain taste in big men, and I have a certain skepticism about Ayton, not because of Ayton, but just because of what the game is. But at the same time, I'm open to seeing. I want to see what kind of value, as you say, a big man with a pretty good floor game and not a great shooter, not terrible. By the way, like, you know, I also think Bagley's a guy who could get to the line 8-9 times a night. Like, I think he could just be like one of those guys. Just watching him on sack. I like his game too. You know, the 4 or 5, it used to be the whole thing as, well, is he 4 or 5 or is, you know, the old Dwayne Casey, you know, you are what you can defend. I mean, I think the answer to 4 or 5 is, you know, you are what you can stretch, right? Like, and I think to some extent that's part of it. I mean, just the notion that you can't have both guys be non-shooters.
I like I like this rookie class a lot. And we haven't even seen Porter, Zaire Smith, somebody else I'm forgetting we haven't seen yet. Lonnie Walker. I like this whole class. Like, Sexton is shooting about 1,000% from mid-range in the last couple of weeks. Kevin Knox hasn't done anything yet. Bridges is fun. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is as advertised. Both Bridges are fun, actually, I should say. Okogie, I'm sad Okogie's not. We're going to talk about the Wolves. I'm sad he's not playing anymore. Chandler Hutchinson, I might want to say put that dude in the dunk contest. If Zach LaVine doesn't want to do it, that Chandler Hutchinson is a mean. So there's a lot of fun guys, a lot of fun rookie. Mitchell Robinson, before he started fouling out in 12 minutes, you know what Mitchell Robinson does? He does the Tim Duncan, Bill Russell thing where he blocks shots to himself or his teammates. I like that. Anyway, none of this is what we're supposed to be talking about.
And by the way, Landry Shamet rhymes with damn it. Not, you know, it's been a very useful little piece.
They have all those little Reddicks running around, all these little damn guys okay. running around screens. Robinhood, listeners, it's an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, cryptos, all commission-free. They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy and the famous. It's simple and intuitive with a clear design and data presented in an easy-to-digest way. That's always essential. Other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees. You can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. You can learn to invest as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies. You have a personalized news feed on there. You can customize notifications for price movements so you never miss the right opportunity to invest. Robinhood right now is giving listeners a free stock, one free stock, Apple, Ford, Sprint, whatever, to help build your portfolio. Sign up at LowPost, the name of this podcast, all one word, lowpost.robinhood.com. That's lowpost.robinhood.com. The perfect transition. I don't know if you did that on purpose. What we were supposed to talk about is we are now 2 weeks removed from Jimmy Butler's first game in Philadelphia. And so I thought that that's now enough time, I think, to talk about the Jimmy Butler nexus of dysfunction. The Bulls, the Wolves, and the Sixers, all of whom have lived his experience in the last year or two. Let's start with Philly because obviously they are now one of the official glamour teams of the NBA. They are 5-2 with Jimmy Butler. They play again tonight, I believe, against the Knicks. Before I get into the numbers, what has stood out to you about the fit of those three guys or just the way the Sixers look in general in the Jimmy Butler era?
I mean, I think he is going to make life, and he's already making life so, so much easier. Because the Sixers are full of really good players who need to each be surrounded by some kind of gravitational force, right? Like, this is how J.J. Redick gets shots. It's not that J.J. can't, quote, create, but, you know, he gets shots because there is space that permits him to find them. You know, this is how Ben Simmons gets space. He's not a guy you can shoot, right? And so certainly Ben can create his own shot off the dribble. He's that freight train. He can do that. But, you know, where does that space come from? You know, this is how Joel Embiid gets behind the defense, those extra few feet where he's not kind of posted up from 19, but he's posted up from like 11. And now he's one drop step and, you know, one dribble and one spin away from just, you know, essentially, you know, kissing the ball off the glass. And Butler providing that in a way that Covington never could. And I'm a huge Robert Covington fan. And we can talk about him in Minnesota, but like, just having that gravity completely decongests this offense. Because as much as, you know, you and I might love what Brett Brown was doing and they're not a pick and roll team and this, you know, all right. But like, you know, at the end of the possession, what's the shot? And oh, by the way, are you throwing the ball away, you know, 18% of the time, you know, which they can do on a bad night. And I just feel like Butler provides that gravitational pull. Yes, he's a closer. Yes. You know, he will take the kinds of shots we've seen in those two game winners. He will win them a basketball game every you know, 12 days on his moxie alone. But I just like what it's going to do for those other guys. And defensively, it's already coming up. Like, I think as recently as a few days ago, they were 16th. They're up to, like, 10th, I think, now. To me, that's auspicious, right? Because we know this, especially with Butler, like, we know this can be a top-five quality defense as they were last year. And so, well, if you add that up, if you add the offensive benefits to what already exists defensively, and in fact hasn't even been factored in because they haven't been playing all that well defensively, there's growth there. Like, I just think they're, you know, they're a contender. And it's going to just do a ton for that, you know, for that team.
It's been much better than I thought it would be right away on offense, particularly considering they have they traded two starters for one. And they have another rotation player who has vanished. Well, he's not vanished. He's there. He's wearing nice clothes on the bench and has some sort of injury. So they've lost net minus two guys who were playing. Now TJ McConnell stepped into one of those roles, so maybe net minus one, whatever. They have scored 113 points per 100 possessions, which is about a top three offense in the NBA equivalent wise since the trade. They have allowed 113, which is very bad, and ranks 23rd since the Butler trade. So the defense has been bad, and that I don't care about. Because
I'll give you an out here. Defensively, they are fifth in opponent shot probability since the trade.
I thought they were third. I looked this up too. I thought sixth
in shot quality. So, but what bottom line is the defense has been bad, but they've actually not been yielding.
Yeah, their shot quality against has been better since the trade, and opponents are shooting some preposterous percentage on mid range shots now. I don't think that's all just bad luck. I do think without Covington, and this is what drove me crazy last year, the league, I have to triple check that this is true, but the league wouldn't let me put Covington as a guard for all defense purposes. And I wanted to put him as a guard because it would have made my first team the way I wanted it. And they're like, no, he's a forward. Ben Simmons is a guard. And I was like, here are statistics showing you that that Robert Covington is the most frequent defender of point guards on the Philadelphia 76ers. On like 59% of possessions, he's defending opposing point guards. Why can't I put him as a guard? And the answer was, well, you can't. Ben Simmons is a guard. And I literally said, well, that's stupid. I protest, but I'm still going to vote the way you tell me to anyway. And so minus Robert Covington, as great as Jimmy Butler is, I think this is actually – there was this whole thing like 4 or 5 years ago, like point guard defense doesn't matter. Point guards are unguardable. It's irrelevant. You can't do anything about them. And every time you'd get to the playoffs, that would be disproven. It was important to have someone who could make their lives a little bit more difficult. And I think we're starting to realize, like, as good as Jimmy Butler is and Ben Simmons can guard literally every position on the floor, it's hard for a guy who's 6'8" to consistently wiggle around and get skinny around those screens and chase Kemba Walker and chase, you know, you name it. Like, that's hard to do. And Covington is just better at that than the guys they've got left over. Markelle Fultz is decent at that, also not playing. I think that they missed that. And so some of those guys are coming at Embiid with a little more daylight on either side of them, and some of those mid-range looks are better than the Sixers probably want them to be. So I think that that's worth monitoring. But in general, given the shots they are allowing, I am not worried about the defense, and I'm very encouraged about how the offense has looked.
No, and the great parable of this, right, and the heartbreak in some ways, was the 2013 Spurs, you know, finals defense where, you know, you so many teams now are making allowances that if you want an open 17-footer, you can have it. And now you just have to kind of negotiate. Well, what is the definition between a ridiculously open 17-footer that, yes, we know it's not a high-percentage shot, but we should probably a little bit contest it, even if it means compromising the scheme, or, hey, you know what, just let them fly. Yeah, if you're going to beat us from 18 tonight, you're going to beat us from 18. I think Philly's trying to figure that out right now. Chandler is the four. Is interesting. He's had this interesting career. He's just, 6'9" wing, which basically means he's a modern four, even though he was a small forward. Yeah, he's never really nudged over that 35% mark from three for sustainable periods of time. He's not a great rebounder, not a great passer. You know, he missed that entire season to the hip injury a few years ago. You know, a decent defender on the perimeter, but probably by virtue of his size more than anything else. He's the classic, oh, so slightly above replacement player that you find on teams' rosters. If not him, there'd be some worse guy. So we'll play him. And now I think they've kind of, I like the way they're sort of using him, which is like, you're going to be at the top of the floor, and your job is to deliver the ball, you know, kind of in our little, you know, early motion over the defense to Joe in an optimal spot. And you know what? If you go watch a lot of Philly possessions, you know, that's kind of what's happening. And like, don't do a hell of a lot. We really don't want to see you work off the dribble, you know? I mean, occasionally you're going to have some sick mismatch, but even that, we don't really play that brand of ball. So it's just been interesting to watch Chandler fill this really, really big role. And I am, you know, fan of the Darius Arch fan club, or I'm the president, or like vice chair, maybe, I don't know. But, you know, seeing that's what they plugged the hole with, like, I'm becoming comfortable with it.
No, I said this the day of the trade. This is what you do with a guy on an affordable contract in Dario and a guy on an affordable post-rookie deal, if not even a rookie deal, post just in a good contract in Covington, who are good players, good, solid fourth starters, whatever they are. You cash them in for a top 20 player, a top 15 player, wherever you have Jets, what you do. And the question just was, is he the right guy? And sometimes you can't get the best right guy. The best right guy might have been Kawhi Leonard or Paul George, a better shooter, a more willing off-ball worker, whatever. But Jimmy Butler is a hell of a guy, and you don't know if a better guy is going to be available next summer, the summer after, then Simmons kicks in. And so far, look, he's not going to shoot 55% from three for the full season. I feel confident about that. But so far, he's fitting in the offense by kind of picking his spots. When Simmons and Embiid are on the floor, here's a stat for you. With Embiid on the floor, Jimmy Butler's usage rate has been 16%, which is like,
wow.
Shockingly
low. Really?
Well, and I'll get to part of the reason why that is.
Wow.
When Embiid's off the floor, it jumps to 28%, which is like superstar level. And part of what's happening is all of those Embiid minutes are also coming with Simmons. He has essentially played, there are almost no, Jimmy Butler, Joel Embiid, no Ben Simmons minutes. I think there are 7 minutes total where Butler and Embiid have played and Simmons is not. And there are 83 minutes of Butler, Simmons, no Embiid. And those are when he's stepping it up and running that nice two-man game with Simmons, with Muscala at the five, spacing a little bit. And when Embiid's on the floor, and which is also meant for Jimmy, that Simmons is on the floor, he's, you know, in the corner, waiting to be a secondary release valve, shooting open threes, cutting back door, which he's very good at, ducking in for favorable, you know, post-up matches when he can play bullball. He's picking his spot, and like, he's good enough to pick his spots for those minutes, assert himself in the other minutes when Joel is sitting, and pick his spots all the way to 20 points a game. Like, he's good enough to do that and play very good defense. Like, it's just, he'll have a shooting slump where it looks a little cramped and gummy and all that, but it's been smoother sailing. Now, I am interested in, and I bet this changes, all that minutes distribution, I bet there becomes more Butler, Embiid, no Simmons minutes. And I'm interested to see sort of how that all looks.
They had a nice little stretch at the beginning of the fourth quarter with McConnell in with those guys. So I think it was like McConnell, Embiid, Butler. I think Chandler and Redick was on the floor. And that's an interesting way to go if you want to get, you know. And you know, will there be a temptation to do some Jimmy time? You know, ISO players against second units are kind of always been interesting experiments. You know, you give that guy, you know, sort of command of the offense for, you know, essentially, I don't know, 7 or 8 possessions. You know, let him go, let him be Jimmy. And I don't want to suggest that Jimmy Butler doesn't function in a structured offense, because I think he does.
But no, that's what we're seeing.
You know, that'll be a temptation.
Well, he's only played, I had this in front of me before, and now I don't. I believe he's only played 3 total minutes as the only one of those big three on the floor. And that's right. Just partly that they have for now 2 seasons very rigidly staggered Simmons and Embiid. So there are almost no minutes when neither of those guys is on the floor.
Right.
And so to your point, I wonder if they tweak that a little bit and let Jimmy cook. But it's been going well offensively. They obviously are going to fill out their roster one way or another. And
they'll get someone.
Yeah, they have this thing happening now where, I mean, the writing isn't just on the wall for Markelle Fultz. It's like Heisenberg's house, abandoned house in Breaking Bad. There's writing all over it. I mean, it's done. He's just not going to be a Sixer for very long. I don't know whether it's this season or next season. I have no idea what his trade value is. But whatever is happening, it's not working, and it just feels like it's reaching a point where it might be unrecoverable.
Yeah, I had a kooky idea on the jump on Monday, which
I saw
latched onto. And I fully knowing that Markelle Fultz does not conform to Travis Schlenk's taste in basketball players, right? Like, I mean, you know, Travis is on the hunt for Klay Thompson, right, to put next to. At least that's the sense. I would argue that if you could have a long, rangy 2 – who is an alternate playmaker and can defend people that so that Trae Young doesn't have to. That's an interesting project, and you have 3 years to build back up the offense. and you have it with a pretty good staff to do that with.
How about my favorite, Marco? Want to hear my favorite? This is my favorite, having done 4 minutes of thinking about just – I've put Markel Fultz in big package deals for Brad Beal and things like this in my brain, but like a
yes.
The standalone Markel is the only thing of significance going out is an exercise I haven't spent all that much time on because nobody knows. Like I pitched one team, and I won't say which team, on would you trade Markel Fultz for a player I would call – let's call unremarkable shooter A. And they were like, oof, I don't know.
They were oof to unremarkable shooter A?
They were, but unremarkable shooter A is good. No, I shouldn't even call him unremarkable. He's good. Good shooter wing A. Good.
Are we like, talking like Wayne Ellington?
About that level. About okay. that level. And not, but not Wayne Ellington.
I was actually trying to specifically guess.
By the way, can we talk about what,
your brain.
The next time I see Wayne, I don't know how he keeps his 5 o'clock shadow. Does he have a 5 o'clock shadow or a beard? Can you?
I mean,
it's just immaculate.
It's kind of a Homer Simpson thing, I'm guessing. Like the guy shaves, and it's like, boop.
I can't, but it's immaculate. Every time I watch the Heat, I spend about 90 seconds of the game thinking about Wayne Ellington's immaculate 5 o'clock shadow / half beard.
By the way, beard trimming technology has improved greatly, and even in the last 5 years with this whole like Portlandia going national beard thing. I'm hoping. Will expire at some point. I just look terrible in a beard.
It's just mesmerizing. Congratulations to Wayne Ellington. Anyway, this team was like, oh, I don't know if we do that for Markel Fultz. It's like the dude was the number one draft pick like yesterday. So I don't know what his trade value is. But what would you say to Markel Fultz for Terrence Ross in a second round pick? I have no idea.
How do you not do that if you're Orlando?
That's what I'm saying. I have no idea if that's not enough for Philly. Obviously, Philly at first blush would say, well, that's not enough for the number one pick. I have no idea what they're going to get. I don't know what they would get if they just held an open auction right now. I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that Philadelphia it needs to understand is it's a sunk cost. There will always be a little sheen on him. You can always say in a sales pitch, oh, by the way, this guy was widely regarded as the best 18-year-old basketball player in the world 2 years ago. And I suppose that lends his value a little bit of froth. But I think you can't just not make good deals or not explore good deals merely because, oh, well, we have two, we're pot committed to this guy. Like, I think you just have to evaluate him based on his assets and liabilities and ceilings and floors. And, you know, if that call comes in from Orlando, I mean, if that call comes into Orlando, I'm Orlando, I take it. I mean, I do think it would be useful for Fultz to be in a place with less media scrutiny that's on a much longer runway. That's why I suggested Atlanta.
I mean,
I think, oh, Atlanta could go do this. It was that Atlanta is the profile of the team where I think Markel could build himself back up without expectation, without media scrutiny, without having to win now. And oh, by the way, I do like it next to tissue paper defense at the one. You have Markel at the two, and I just think Markel can really be an outstanding, outstanding guard defender in this league.
He's not a fit. Markel Fultz right now is not a fit anywhere, but he's not a fit necessarily with Aaron Gordon, Mo Bamba and Jonathan Isaac, if that's your front line of the future, ignoring the fact that Nikola Vucevic is absolutely tearing up the NBA. But I don't think Orlando cares. And look, Sixers fans are going to say, Terrence Ross, he's an expiring contract. Yeah, he's shooting the hell out of it this year. He's still expiring. And a second round pick from the Magic? Well, that's all we get from Markel Fultz? I've had people from other teams ask me, hey, do you think the Sixers might have to attach a pick to get rid of Markel Fultz? He's on a rookie deal, so we don't think he makes any money. He makes $9.7 million next year, and then he has a player option for $12.3, which is a bad news proposition. The bad news is if he's like kind of okay, maybe then you exercise it and it's $12.3 million. And if he still is a nothing, then you just decline it and you've lost Markel Fultz. So I don't know that he has I don't know what kind of trade value has, but I don't know that offer that I just made up out of thin air is like a crazy offer because he makes $10 million a year next year and he is providing zero. I mean, on the floor, he was okay. He pushed the pace. He had some nice assist games. He can pass it. Right now, he's not on the floor. And I, like, what faith do I have that he is not going to, in a month, go see another specialist and another one and another one? Like, how can I know he's ever going to be on the floor?
You don't. And that's, therein lies the fun of this game that we're playing, which is we can't assess his value with any certainty. And with, we're not even with any certainty, with any real criteria. Because as you say, hey, it's not one of these, oh, yeah, but he's on his rookie deal situations, right? Like, you know, by virtue of being the number one pick, it's far more money than trading a guy who came in at 16 or 17 slot in the draft. And again, I mean, the elasticity of what you can expect from this guy in the next 2 or 3 years, I don't know if there's been a player with that kind of variance, right? Like, he, what if he just learns to get back to, you know, forget like Washington, like Salt Lake Summer League 2017.
You can't stop talking about Salt Lake Summer League.
I wasn't there in 2017. I just know he had, I just watched a game from my office in Los Angeles where he was just playing great. You know, that was probably the last great, great game he's had in a Sixer uniform, if I'm correct.
People, we're never going to agree on everything, but I think we can agree on this. Everybody needs more sleep. My daughter has been a train wreck 2 nights in a row, and I'm dying. We all need more sleep. And getting a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think. You don't need a super expensive mattress. You should definitely not get sleeping pills. You just need to change your sheets and check out Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and somehow get even softer over time. You buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets, and this is no joke, can cost you up to $1,000 in the store. I mean, who's buying $1,000 sheets? Royalty? That's ridiculous. But Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple hundred bucks. Everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, they've all talked about Boll & Branch. Even three U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a refund. Boom. But I doubt that you want to send them back. There's no risk, no reason not to give them a try. And to get you started right now, my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com if you use the promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Go to bollandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, for $50 off your first set of sheets. Speaking of Salt Lake Summer League, I'm going to come out against this right now. The NBA moving the G League showcase to Las Vegas is a big fat no. And the NBA, there's this little creep going on where the NBA is starting to make Las Vegas its West Coast hub, even over LA. Like, wouldn't shock me if the NBA opens an office in either LA or Vegas in the next 5 years. And G League showcase is there. Summer League is like a mega event. I love Summer League. I got one Vegas trip in me. I have 1 6-day stint in Vegas where I love every second of it. I just don't want to go back. Why can't we have the G League showcase in Chicago? Why can't we have it in Texas? Why can't we have it in why does it have to be on these extremes? Why does it have to be in Toronto by the freaking?
I want to go to Chicago in January.
You want to go to Vegas again? You don't even go to Summer League.
No, I don't want to go to Vegas. You know where they should do it next year? And you're going to laugh, and it's a hometown thing. Atlanta is opening up a
fine
G League gym 10 minutes from the airport that has a nonstop to literally every place in the world. Like just do it in College Park. You know, do Atlanta, you know, it can be chilly in January. It's not great, but you're not going to be, I'm not walking up Michigan Avenue in January in Chicago. Are you kidding me?
You sounded like Patino right there, as Amin would say. I'm not walking up, but Kevin Arnovitz isn't walking up Michigan Avenue. Anyway,
not in January.
Do you want to talk about the Wolves and do you want to talk about the Wolves and the Bulls? The other,
yeah, let's talk about the Wolves and the Bulls for a little bit. Just the post Jimmy.
Yeah, I don't really want to, but go ahead. Sell me on why they're interested. Obviously, the Wolves have played very well. Their defense is tightened up. Everybody's happy. Andrew Wiggins has missed a million shots in a row. Tell me what's interesting.
I mean, they're interesting. They're deeper. They're actually not getting great shots, but they're a lot better defensively, which is interesting to me, and I think speaks to Covington, who's the ultimate like Tibbsian character, if there ever was one. I watching Wiggins on the bench each of the past two nights in the last two games in the fourth quarter, that's also interesting.
Correct me if I'm wrong. They won a game where Covington and Wiggins were 1 for 30 combined. I believe that happened.
Must have been the 0 for 12 and 1 for 18, maybe.
That's incredible.
I mean, here's a question. When we tally up Thibodeau's makes and misses during his tenure as the czar of the Minnesota Timberwolves, I mean, where are we going to rank the Wiggins extension? You know, he's on the books forever. I mean, I think you and I will be taking Social Security, and Wiggins will still be being paid in excess of $30-something million by the Minnesota Timberwolves. I didn't realize how far. Like, I don't even think our Excel spreadsheet prepared by the brilliant Bobby Marks even, like, goes as far as Wiggins' extension.
There's just an arrow pointing to the right. Just follow this arrow.
It's just a little trail of dollars across your screen for Andrew Wiggins. He's just going to be collecting money from the Minnesota Timberwolves and Glenn Taylor while he's sitting on the bench in the fourth quarter. And I just wonder where, for all of the missteps and mismanagement in Minnesota, whether that will rank, you know, forget just the Butler trade, which I think you've spoken well on this, which is, again, was definitely, I think, worth the risk. But, you know, the Wiggins extension. And the thing about Karl-Anthony Towns is he's having a really nice stretch, and he's not even shooting that well from distance, but he's gotten so good at putting the ball on the floor against, like, both defenders who close and the guys who are, like, just one step slow on the switch when he slips along the perimeter. He has a really quick release. And I've been having fun watching Towns again. You know, here was this guy that the GM survey 2 years ago said is the guy you'd want to plan build a franchise around, literally gets, I think, zero votes in the same category 1 year later, has kind of become this Beto Nwaor. He's soft. He doesn't play defense. He's a stat monger. Jimmy's criticism essentially is an implicit indictment of his desire to win. And now all of a sudden I'm having really a lot of fun again watching Karl-Anthony Towns. He's so freaking talented. There's so many things you can do with him offensively. Yeah, I watched the other night, they deployed this little weave action with, like, I think the point guard was Tyus, Wiggins, and then Towns comes third, and he has the option to return the ball to the point guard, but he also can just take off in one stinking dribble and get to the cup because the defense just didn't anticipate what was going to happen. And why didn't they anticipate what was going to happen? Because Karl-Anthony Towns can do about 11 different things to kill you when he has the ball at any spot on the floor. And so I'm kind of, after all the Towns and the drama, like, I'm decided, especially because you get to listen to the Minnesota crew when you watch these games, which is nice, but I'm getting excited about watching Towns play basketball again. And that's been the case. That's why I wanted to talk. I kind of wanted just to come back around. I've been critical of Towns.
Well, look, with Towns' ceiling is going to be defense. If he decides to care about defense, which he has been doing since Butler got traded, he is going to be a top 10 at worst player in the NBA and has a chance to be a top 5 player for a long portion of his career once the Warriors guys age out of that ranking and all that. If he doesn't care about defense, he still has a chance to be literally the most well-rounded offensive big man in the history of basketball. He can shoot 40%. He has shot 40% from three. He can post up against any matchup and get to the rim. He's a great rebounder. He can work off the dribble. He can roll to the rim faster than you blink your eye. He can do all that. Like, he's more versatile offensively in some ways. Like, Anthony Davis doesn't have his handle. Anthony Davis is a little...
Or his range.
Or his range. He's a little smoother. He's a little quicker, like, twitchier maybe. I've always said I'd rather have Anthony Davis than Karl Towns. It's not particularly close right now. But he has a chance to be a almost, you don't want to say Dirk level because there's only one Dirk, but a 50-40-90 level shooter with a baby Shaq kind of post game. And that maybe baby Shaq is too much, but with a post game that if you don't double team him, even against guys about his size, he's going to get a good shot.
Yeah, I mean, and it's been, and again, one of the reasons I'm finding this interesting is just finding the Wolves interesting is I'm enjoying watching him play again. They look it's still a Tibbs team, so in the words of a veteran who I talked to a couple years ago, they will still forever look like a team that looks like they had recess taken away for their entire year, which was how this veteran describes Tibbs' teams. But Towns individually is just been fun to watch.
Is recess still a thing?
What?
Is recess still a thing in elementary school? I assume it is, right? You get recess?
I guess.
The way that kids are overworked now, I wonder if recess is now turned into, like, study hall. Recess
can
is
I ask
the
question?
Best.
Are they overworked, or they just like spend all of their downtime like staring at phones?
No, they're all. It's worse than when we were kids. It's the parents' fault. I hope I'm not going to be like this, but it's like they take 9,000 AP classes. They have to play 40 sports, or they have to play one sport super intensely that they wake up at 5. It's too much. Anyway, my daughter, my plan is, my wife was a very good college tennis player. My plan is that my daughter is going to be a tennis prodigy, and I will be the boisterous father in the box at Wimbledon who may have to get escorted out of the crowd. That's my life goal.
My sister was a nationally ranked tennis junior, my little sister, briefly. Actually got a game off of Chanda Rubin in a national tournament. Got beat 0-0 against Lindsay Davenport, but, you know, acquitted herself as well as you can in an 0-0 match. But it was like, it did require what you're talking about. Like, I would have to, like, I would drive her down, you know, when I was 17 or 18 to, like, Macon, Georgia, where there'd be, like, the big regional tournament, you know, and we'd stay and look into next to the tennis thing, and you were just kind of there all the time, and it was like 92 degrees, and it was just, it's really intense. I mean, I don't think she missed out on a lot. She was not super, 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 you know, elite, but she wasn't, you know, she had a national ranking, and the Southeast is competitive. But yeah, it's, I mean, you got to really want it. I mean, it's not, I don't recommend it unless your daughter is completely like obsessive.
Yeah, I believe it was Mirjana Lucic, my wife played against when they were kids in Croatia, and Lucic, who became a pro, kicked their ass. But I'm hoping for that. Kirby, by the way, you see who won the Davis Cup?
No, I didn't see who won the Davis Cup.
Croatia. Big year for Croatia.
If you ask the question, I should know the answer.
Listeners, when you think of the perfect holiday gift, you probably do not think of an electric toothbrush, but the Quip electric toothbrush that you've heard me talk about before is one of the most popular holiday gifts of the season, and here's why. It's perfect for everyone with a mouth, which is almost everyone, and it's something they'll use twice a day if they are on point. Quip brushes have little sonic vibrations that are gentle on your sensitive gums, and they have a built-in timer with guiding pulses to remind you when to switch sides so you brush every part of your mouth equally. It makes holiday travels clean and easy with a multi-use cover that mounts to mirrors. That's always convenient, and unmounts to slide over the bristles for on-the-go brushing. It doesn't require a clunky charger, and it runs for 3 months. That's 25% of the year on one charge. It is the gift that keeps refreshing with brush heads automatically delivered by Quip on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. And you can even gift prepaid refills for a year to make sure that whoever you give it to is not using old or worn out bristles. Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association as thousands of verified 5-star reviews. That's why I love Quip and why you should try it too. Quip looks like a big ticket tech gift with a stocking stuffer price starting at just $25. That's not even close to what you would think an electric toothbrush at the high end would cost. And if you go to getquip.com/low, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast, that's getquip.com, you get your first refill pack for free with the purchase of a Quip electric toothbrush. And you don't have to tell the person that you buy the gift that you got it for free. Again, that's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/low, my last name, L-O-W-E.
By the way, you know who we have to talk about when we talk about Minnesota?
Sarge?
Well, no, although that I can see why you thought I was leading you that way. Is Derrick Rose the sixth man of the year right now?
I mean, he's got a gaze. Is he going to continue shooting this well? I mean,
no, but sixth man of the year is going to be a rollicking race. In my zeal and excitement at what Montrezl Harrell has done for the Clippers, I prematurely handed him the award on my last podcast without thinking about it. Derrick Rose leads all bench players in scoring in the entire NBA, in points per game anyway. Here is their on-off rankings with Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose on the floor, 111 points per 100 possessions. Off the floor, 98. Defense is about the same. He is the single biggest, he has the best net rating on the Wolves, and it's not even close. It's not close. And then you throw in Harrell, Sabonis, who I think is fifth in the whole league in PER. I don't know if Sabonis has missed the whole year. Every time I check a Pacers box score, a game I don't watch, he's 8 of 8 and has 40 rebounds. It's ridiculous. Lou Williams,
Dinwiddie,
it's
Julius
Williams.
Julius Randle second, I think, in bench scoring quietly for the Pelicans is second.
Julius Randle is the Lou Williams of power forwards.
Ooh, I like that.
I mean, this guy comes in, it is, and I got to follow them for a few days. I mean, he just comes in and just has his absolute way. He gets whatever the hell he wants for like 6 minute stretches. It's a really big. By the way, I picked Tyreke Evans preseason. I've been a little disappointed. If he could just bring up his field goal percentage from two, I mean, he's doing five from three.
Well, you know who I picked? I did even worse. Yeah. Terry Rozier.
Manu Ginobili?
Terry Rozier, who has been fine, whatever, but not playing enough minutes. I thought he would butt his way into more minutes than this, particularly with Hayward struggling. And Tyreke was the guy I wrote I was most worried about. I thought that Tyreke is just sort of your tailor-made. He can play on the ball, off the ball. He'll close every game. He'll average 15, 6, and 6 for a winning team. It was like a tailor-made six-man of the year candidate. It just hasn't happened.
Yeah, I mean, then again, he just hasn't been terrible. I mean, I think they'll – I mean, even a regression to the mean will bring him back up to that. He just hasn't been there. This is a fun six – because I feel like for years we were sort of in the – is it Ginobili, Crawford, Lou Williams? You know, we got a little new infusion last year with Van Vliet, but like I feel like it's been the usual suspects for the better part of a generation, and it's kind of going to be fun because we have the completely new, especially with the Rose storyline, right? So you have a former MVP who's actually still technically in his age prime, who is now a candidate. It's going to be a fun race.
It is. I've said it on the podcast. I thought Derrick Rose was done as an NBA, as a good NBA player. I just thought it's over. Like, he just can't play anymore. Can't make shots. Can't defend anybody. This has been more than just random shot making to me. He's playing well. He's actually playing well. And he's found his niche as this combo guard who has a traditional point guard next to him, so he doesn't have to run the offense. He can kind of attack gaps, get into the lane. Now, again, he's not going to shoot. I think he's shooting almost 50% from three, whatever it is. He's not going to shoot that way. He's playing well, and I was wrong. I didn't see it coming. And he's averaging 19 points a game. He's shooting 46% from three. It's incredible, and I don't mean that in good or bad. I just mean it's incredible in the sense that it is not even credible to me that he's doing this, because I thought he was done as an NBA player, period, as a good NBA player. And look, he looked that way. Cleveland got rid of him. The Jazz waived him. Nobody wanted him. Tibbs was the only one who would give him a chance. And to his credit, he's playing good basketball.
Yeah, I'd love to know the rehab story. I mean, I'm always interested in how bodies are restored. Like, what was the magic elixir? Be fun to talk to the sports science guys. I mean, I don't know if they'll guard that information. Everything in Minnesota is guarded, but I'd love to know more about that, because it's obviously a statement of commitment from him, but also I'm always curious in the medical technology that helps facilitate that. So anyway, that'd be interesting.
What's interesting about the Bulls?
Other than
Zach LaVine is now shooting 30% from three and 43% overall.
You know what? Yes, Zach LaVine. Let me come down the floor, post up Bryn Forbes from 20 feet, get to 18 feet, and launch a turnaround jump.
Wow, I did not expect this, Kevin Arnovitz.
There's not one survey of the floor, not one inkling that a basketball possession is full of cool possibilities, that there are three guys standing behind the arc with a Spurs defense that's sort of playing middle, and not, if not packed, certainly playing off the perimeter. You know, and it's just like the ball hoggery right now, especially when you factor in Jabari, is just tough to watch. LaVine feels like he's the guy. Jabari's playing for a contract. A lot of these possessions with like dribble handoff action, the defenders snip out, then there's like this mass confusion because, well, I didn't really want to give up the ball anyway, right? And then going back to your sort of Carl Anthony Towns thing, like at some point, is Zach LaVine going to decide whether he wants to play a functional brand of defense as a player in the NBA?
And see, actually,
all these theories. His athleticism is vertical. It's not lateral. Like, whatever.
Look, Zach LaVine has already appeared as a like in my 10 things column earlier this year. I respect the way he's attacking the rim. The team is absolutely terrible. Archie Diacono is playing. I got to get my Neil Funk voice on, actually. Archie Diacono. I can't do it. You know, it's just he's got this Archie Diacono.
Yeah, Archie Diacono.
Archie Diacono is playing like 40 minutes a game at point guard. It's just they're just not
a bad pick and roll player.
No, he's shooting well from three, but half their team is injured. I mean, so many of their guys, Markkanen's injured, Dunn's injured, Portis is injured. I'm surely forgetting somebody that's also injured. It's not their real team, and so he's having to do too much, and their offense without him has been terrible. And now that his shooting has regressed past the mean, I'm back to this, like, he's averaging 25 points a game. I just not sure it matters if you're shooting just okay to like below average and your assist to turnover ratio is 1-to-1 and your defense, it's actually an interesting contrast going back to what we were talking about with Ayton, where I can see Ayton's thought process happening and he's just making, almost like the right decision at the wrong time, which makes it the wrong decision, but you can see what I'm saying. I don't see a thought process with Zach LaVine. I just see a guy like running around with his head like turning like he's watching the birds or something. Like I just don't, I just don't know that it matters, but Markkanen is coming back soon. I cannot wait to see the Markkanen Carter front court. And that
that's going to be my good news.
That's the thing. That everything else, like Zach LaVine was this nice sideshow for a while. Put him back in a complimentary role where he shoots more spot up shots. He shoots more threes. He's not running as much as the offense. Let that front court be the fulcrum of your team. Now I'm interested again.
Yeah. No, look, one of the regrets I have right now is that I wish Wendell Carter Jr. had a better tour guide on the floor. Because I love the Carter market in front court. You know, Carter is a rugged defender who can rebound. You know, he's a tough big to handle in a switchy league, you know, especially once he finds his stroke from distance, which I'm convinced he's going to. And I just wish that there was a better tour guide. And I don't mean any
Archie Diacono.
I had it earlier. This is crazy. It is a nice player, but I just feel like a guy like Carter under the direction of it doesn't have to be like an old graybeard point guard who's gonna, you know, this doesn't have to be Chris Paul, like just, you know, a capable floor general where he's not watching bad possessions being just propagated by his selfish wing guy. Like, it's just depressing. And I mean, I've really tried to give LaVine a chance, and I know they're leaning on him, and I get that. But when the vast majority of your value is derived from your usage rate, like, you know what? You're just a good player destined to be good player on a bad team, no matter where you go.
Well, I just still think he is a useful, he's clearly a useful player. You don't average 25 points in the league. I don't care how they're happening. You don't do that without being a useful and possibly good player. Because he has been until the ACL tear, a very good 3-point shooter on tough shots. If you make those a little bit easier by making him the second or third option and get him to be just a slightly below average defender and for a lower usage wing and actually okay playmaker, then you've got something. You've got to, of course, pay him accordingly to that and put him in that role and pay him accordingly, which is a challenge. Let's finish with this. Who's the MVP right now? I can't think of it. Normally 20 games in, I have one award decided in my head. And there's like a clear front runner for one of the awards. Is there a front runner like for any of the awards? Like you could say Doc Rivers, but you could name me a couple other coaches. Like I just named Sixth Man of the Year, maybe Rookie of the Year, Doncic. It's very cloudy.
It is cloudy. I mean, I wrote last week I have a pick'em between Giannis and LeBron. Last week I leaned LeBron. Now I'm probably with Giannis. You know, look, if Steph can play 60, but he's already down 10 games. I mean, if Steph can come back anytime soon, I think he will reemerge. You know, AD is always AD, right? Like, AD is going to finish third in this race, no matter who finishes first or second. You know, Durant is an interesting candidate, but at this point, I'm there. If there's not one frontrunner, I think LeBron and Giannis are just kind of, for me, out there with the asterisk for Curry, which is if he can just get back on the floor.
Curry's missed 10 games. That's
right.
About
so what's our max for an MVP.
The least ever is Walton at 58, and that is a complete outlier. For non-lockout, non-1950s seasons, the floor is about where Steph is now if he plays every single game. So if he's another five games missed. Yeah, he's another five games missed from being, rightly or wrongly, at least by historical criteria, not the MVP. I agree he would be the MVP right now if he had continued to play at that level. Giannis, LeBron, yeah. I mean, Kawhi is shooting 33% from deep. He's had a wonderful year. I think KD's actually kind of played his way into the conversation in the last week, but that just feels a little messy. Embiid, and if you look at their numbers, when Embiid plays without Simmons, they're very good, and when Simmons plays without Embiid, they're again very bad. Now, that changed last year. It may change again. He's not uninteresting to me.
You know what's funny? I had him on my player compare. You know, you can line up six players to kind of, and that's kind of how I do this on basketballreference.com. And I have Embiid. My concern with Embiid has nothing to do with Embiid, which is I just feel like Butler's presence will dilute some of his numbers just by virtue that he's just going to, you know, he'll get the ball just a little bit less. I mean, which just sort of exposes some of the fallacy of the award is that, okay, so this. By the way, by virtue of Embiid being on the roster, Philadelphia becomes an attractive destination for a guy like Butler. And yet, ultimately, I think Butler's arrival will probably hurt Embiid's candidacy.
And then you get the Defensive Player of the Year. Just your sort of rotating top three for the last 3 years has been Kawhi, Draymond, and Gobert. And it just feels like none of them have taken the season on that end of the floor by the throat. Now, Draymond has been very good, and if you look at the Warriors on off numbers, their defense has been mediocre, except when Draymond's been on the floor, it's been top two level elite as usual. Something is off with Utah, and I think Gobert is part of it. I don't think Gobert is the same as what he was, and Kawhi's been good, but not 2 years ago good or 3 years ago good. And that's why people have thrown Marc Gasol into the void. They have, I think, the second best defense in the league. He's number one in our adjusted plus minus or real plus minus thing. And yet you look at some other numbers, like opponents are shooting 65% at the rim or something, 64% when Mark is the closest defender, which is like kind of bad. No one loves Marc Gasol more than me. Everyone knows. Maybe you do. I don't know. My love of Marc, I have a whole column named after
Marc Gasol.
No, you
love him more than I do.
I love Marc Gasol. He's a little persnickety, but I love him.
I didn't like some of his conduct last year, but whatever.
Yeah, no, it was, there's a lot of stuff on both sides of that. I can't say that I've watched the Grizzlies this year and thought he looks as airtight defensively as he did the year he won the Defensive Player of the Year, or he looks like the best defense player in the NBA right now. He looks good, and offensively he looks fantastic, which adds up to about peak Marc Gasol. I just haven't watched Memphis and thought, well, I got to put him at Defensive Player of the Year.
Here are a couple guys I'm watching for sort of a new breed, and just watching because I think they're interesting. Giannis is one. I think Paul George is having an exceptional year defensively. You know, and he, you know, he's a guy we always thought would be in this conversation. You know, then we had the sort of elite three or four, and he was just below it. But they're playing a great brand of team defense, and he's been really, really good. So I'm watching him. I always, and you know, we're trying to, well, why is Denver all of a sudden a good defensive team? Well, I mean, they have a guy back named Paul Millsap. And, you know, Millsap's probably not going to be the defensive player of the year, but I think when we start figuring out our first team, he's a guy we need to look at. You know, AD, if I keep calling them the Hornets, the Pelicans can improve their D. And, like, look, if Tibbs keeps playing Covington 36 minutes a night, which he seems inclined to do.
I like that name. That's a good call.
I mean, I got to tell you, like if he's stable, let me do this. Let's say he stabilizes that defense. Let's say that the last couple weeks haven't been an anomaly. That all of a sudden, when you have that guy as the defensive fulcrum, that team, which has been 30th and 30th, I mean, they are awful, and they have been awful since, you know, the great defensive innovator got there, okay? And all of a sudden, they become a 10, a 9, or an 8. They work their way back into the playoffs. Like, you know, I'm going to look at Covington. And maybe he's the guy who takes kind of, you know, either the Kawhi or whoever, you know, the wing guy in that sort of and triumvirate. You know, we usually look at one classic big, one Draymond-y AD-ish hybrid-y, and then we look at like one perimeter guy like Kawhi, right? Like, and maybe those distinctions are too fine, but I will look at Covington because, and by the way, our defensive RPM numbers love him as well. I mean, they've got him like he is the only perimeter guy in the top like 22, and then it's like Kyle Anderson. Actually, no, I think I have Paul George at 17. George is the other one. So those are guys I'm looking at. And I will obviously continue to watch the usual suspects.
Denver's bench defense and bench overall has been fantastic. And I was just watching their Lakers game last night, this morning, and that didn't really make a lot of sense. The game that occurred last night, I watched this morning. You know, it's like Mason Plumlee will never be able to live up to his contract because he plays 17 minutes a game. He can't be on the floor with their best player. They seem to have given up for the most part. Once every 10 games, you'll see some Jokic Plumlee minutes. But for what he's, those 17 minutes this year, he has been really, really good. I mean, both ends of the floor, rebounding, defense, he's been really good. Like their bench is unpleasant to play against and is winning minutes for them. And just, you know, we sometimes do this thing where we define players by their contract. He's overpaid. It's not Mason Plumlee's fault that the Nuggets, even though Mason Plumlee had zero leverage, zero offers, zero anything, gave him starting center money, more than Yusuf Nurkic is making. In his minutes, he's playing well.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's always been kind of a bias when we watch is, you know, it's clearly called the Joe Johnson effect. Right, like a guy just gets completely pummeled relative to expectation, and why are the expectations what they are? Because he's getting paid a fortune. And at the end of the day, okay, this guy, that's a sunk cost. Let's evaluate him as a basketball player with assets and liabilities, and what is he doing for you? I've always loved Plum, and just because I, you know, we all have our biases, the kinds of players that we overvalue. Like, I always overvalue defensive point guards. Like, I still believe in Chris Dunn. Like, I will always be a Bledsoe guy, even though he can drive me crazy offensively. And I like big men who can pass. Like, I will always overvalue Blake Griffin for that reason, right? Like, and guys like Plumlee, just because I like a big man who can pass. Just kind of a cool thing to have a guy that big, you know, who's looking that way. So
absolutely.
Those are my biases.
Where are you off to next? You went to Atlanta. You're back in L.A. What's your next? Can you disclose your next NBA location?
Yeah, I'm going to go. I think I'm going to go hang out with the Milwaukee Bucks for a little while.
Ooh, bud.
I'm going to go hang out with the Bucks. I want to check in on the Bucks. I actually had committed to kind of a sugar-free or dessert-free 2018, and I've been really good, but like Cop's frozen custard beckons, and it's like, I'm just not going to get out of Milwaukee without a little bit of that stuff. So maybe this is where I can kind of, you know, treat myself. We'll be, I think, with them in Indiana and Cleveland, in December, and I've decided to drive because there are no sensible non-stops between some of these cities. So, I don't drive in snow. It's just kind of a rule, so I'm kind of potentially in trouble here. But I will be, I'll be going to Indiana, and I have not been at that arena. It's one of, like, the two arenas I haven't been to.
It's a beautiful arena. It's a beautiful – I think Indianapolis is actually underrated as a city, and that arena is awesome.
Oh, no. And I'm planning dinner at Bluebeard, which is one of my favorite NBA city restaurants, is Bluebeard, named after Kurt Vonnegut, who was an Indiana – or an Indianapolis native. So I've got that set up for the off night. And, I'm looking forward to going. You know, it's fun to go on the road with a team. You know, like, you can go drop in their home arena for five nights during a homestand. But guys have places to be and things to do. And you get them in kind of a cold-weather city on a weeknight, like, yeah, you know, people are just kind of just hanging out. So I'm going to do that with the Bucks, I think, for a little while, and then we'll see.
Nice. I am with our giant crew going to Toronto next week.
Yes.
We're doing stuff there.
All-access game.
Yes.
The Raps all-access game. I think I'm writing a kind of an opening essay for that for digital. So
very nice.
I have to write my Raptors reflective, contemplative, big picture looking down from 30,000 feet at this franchise piece that I'm going to be writing in the next few days that we'll publish then. So I guess that's my next kind of, other than my just massive contribution to the power rankings blurbs, I think that's the next thing I'll have on the site.
Nice. Well, look forward to that. I you know, I have a soft spot for Toronto. So I'm excited for that trip. Excited for that piece. Kevin Arnovitz, look for that. Look for everything he does. Kevin, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.